Hello. Last time I talked about the mode of rule, the ideology of rule that in an extraordinarily successful way supported pharaohs in a unified Egypt for nearly 3,000 years. This ideology of rule involved an identification, ritual identification, a personal identification, even a bureaucratic and economic identification between the person of the pharaoh, the person of the ruler, and Egypt itself. The vitality of the ruler was central, was necessary, was in fact the same thing as the vitality of the state. Both the ruler, and through the ruler, the Nile and the floods of the Nile nourished the Egyptian state in every sense, agriculturally, spiritually, politically. So I noted last time, this is not a form, an ideology of rule that exists in Mesopotamia. So what I want to do today is talk a little bit more, in a bit more detail, and a bit more explicitly, comparatively, about similarities and differences between these two regions. Because, as I've said, one of the characteristics of archaeology as a science is its comparative focus. It's far more interesting to us, far more productive for us as archaeologists, if we can not merely examine the processes, the developments of culture and politics and economy and religion in different areas, but if we can compare them in order to tease out the common threads, begin to identify common underlying factors that may lead to similar results, or sometimes very different results in different areas. So let's do that. States develop in Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley at almost the same time. Really, given the imprecision of our dating, essentially the same time, toward the end of the 4th millennium BC. We can argue, and archaeologists argue incessantly, about whether the small political units of late pre-dynastic Egypt and of Uruk period Mesopotamia were states. I think it's quite reasonable to think of them as states, as small developing states. Certainly by 3000 BC, states existed in both areas. There's some evidence of at least trading contacts between the two areas. In fact, in some ways, on objects like the palette of Narmer, for example, we can see perhaps at least artistic influences from Mesopotamia to Egypt. So, simultaneous development, some degree of contact between the two areas. But the results of this process, this political and social process towards statehood, were very different in both of these regions. Mesopotamian civilization, let's recap, had the following characteristics. Early dynastic political developments involve a constellation of city-states arranged along the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. In all, about 12 major cities existed during the early dynastic period, in the early 3rd millennium BC. There were about 20 to 30 smaller centers associated with them. These 12 major centers included places like Eridu, Uruk, Ur, Lachish, Kish, Nippur, Akkad, and so on. Most of these centers had already at this point been occupied for hundreds, or in some cases, as with Eridu, thousands of years. Populations in these city-states were in the range of 20,000 to as many as 75,000 people, depending on time and place. The territories of these city-states were maximally perhaps 120 kilometers or approximately 70 miles away from the capital, towards the frontiers. Large proportions of the populations lived in the urban centers, particularly given the hyper-urbanism characteristic of settlement patterns during the early dynastic. As the countryside cleared out to some degree, at least in part because of conflicts between these states, given the relatively small territorial size of the states and the relatively large size, certainly in terms of population of the urban centers, we can see why there is a real concentration of economic and political power in those urban centers. What else can we say? Political organization was still oriented around individual urban centers, around these city-states, and the leaders and the elites in each. There were later attempts at unification. Sargon of Akkad, at about 2350 BC, founded a state that ruled most of Mesopotamia for about a century. This was followed by a succession of states and rulers attempting to do the same thing. In Ur, at about 2000 BC, in Babylon, most famously under Hammurabi, between about 2000 and 1700 BC, and under the Assyrians, after about 1350 BC. However, even after the early dynastic, the dispersal of political power among the rulers of different city-states is quite striking. Rule over larger territories was unstable and tended to be prone to breakup. On the other hand, we can certainly talk about a Mesopotamian civilization at this time, with common cultural and political forms linking many of these city-states, especially in southern Mesopotamia. The role of the temple, and so of the gods, in both political and economic life was very striking through the area, and this is reflected in a similar pantheon across at least southern and central Mesopotamia. A common understanding of the role of the king was widespread, and southern Mesopotamia also shared fairly standardized writing and notation systems. So there is a sense of unity, but it's not political unification. Mesopotamian city-states were significantly multi-ethnic, and even, in some cases, in many cases, multilingual within this larger common cultural sphere. Okay, what about Egypt? Classical Egyptian civilization looks very different. We speak of an Egyptian state in the singular and not in the plural. This Egyptian state existed and was seen by Egyptians as a territorial entity extending for more than 1,200 kilometers along the Nile, 800 miles along the Nile. Significantly larger area, at least linearly, than that associated with any of the Mesopotamian city-states. Now, this area, extensive area along the Nile, did encompass two different and original cultural regions, Upper and Lower Egypt. There were similarities between these two areas, but in the pre-dynastic period, there was also significant difference between the two. But it was a large territorial state. Egyptian unification after 3100 BC resulted in a nearly unparalleled continuity of political and ritual institutions. It's really quite extraordinary. More continuity over a longer period of time than really any case that we're going to examine in the rest of the set of lectures. The one case that comes closest is probably Chinese civilization. As I mentioned last time, the 30th dynasty of Egypt ended only in the 4th century BC, after more than 2,500 years, and even after that, Egyptian rulers, many of them of foreign origins, still felt it politic to keep at least some of the trappings, these old, by this time, old, antique trappings of pharaonic rule. This is a record utterly unequaled in Mesopotamia. This state, this Egyptian state over more than 2,500 years, was heavily centralized under the pharaoh through a complex bureaucracy at local, regional, and national levels, a multi-tiered, highly centralized, and quite pervasive bureaucracy. The pharaoh was seen as personification of the whole country, and his extraordinary mortuary architecture, the pyramids, for example, was necessary to the preservation of his body and thus the maintenance of order in the Nile Valley and in the cosmos as a whole. It's sometimes said that Egyptian society was not an urban society, and that is not exactly entirely true. There were substantial urban centers at Nekhen, Hierakonpolis, for example, at Memphis, later at Thebes, and so on, but usually just two or three centers important at a single time, and these were usually, generally smaller urban centers than existed in Mesopotamia at the same period. The vast majority of people in Egypt didn't live in cities, and urbanism was not a dominating feature of the state, of the territory as a whole, as it certainly was in the Mesopotamian case. There's far less evidence for a merchant class and for complex trading systems in the Nile Valley than was the case in Mesopotamia. I mean, as I talked about the development of the state in Mesopotamia, what's one of the first manifestations of this expansive, really very dynamic Mesopotamian civilization? The Uruk trading system. Because the Uruk trading system involves contacts over a long distance, but not only contacts, contacts that, among other things, involve the exportation of prestigious goods. This is not merely an economic network, it's also a network of acquisition of valued and rare items. That didn't exist in the Egyptian case. Ethnic differences do not seem to have been as important in Egypt as they were in Mesopotamia. Egypt was more homogeneous both culturally and linguistically than Mesopotamia was. So one issue is, how do we understand? How can we understand these differences? Can we think about them in any organized comparative way? First thing I need to note, and I'm an academic, so I can never say anything without qualifying it, is that it's possible to overemphasize the differences between Mesopotamia and Egypt. As I've noted, there was some degree of cultural unity in Mesopotamia. This Mesopotamian civilization that provided a common cultural basis for interactions across large areas of territory and among very, very large populations. So there was that degree of cultural commonality. Equally, in Egypt, We do see some degrees of regional distinction, especially between Upper and Lower Egypt in earlier times. It really isn't very great, but it does exist. I would note, is just to give one example of quite striking difference, when I spoke about Mesopotamian cuneiform writing, I noted that it was used by speakers of a whole variety of different languages and was actually used to transcribe a whole variety of different languages. Elamite, Sumerian, Akkadian, Hittite, and so on. There's no evidence that Egyptian hieroglyphics were ever used to write any language but ancient Egyptian. Now, one thing to note here is that this language is not obviously the language that people speak in Egypt today. People in Egypt today now, for the most part, speak Arabic and have, particularly in urban areas, over most of the last approximately 1,300 years. Ancient Egyptian, the language spoken by Egyptians at 3000 BC and thereafter, belongs to a different branch of a larger language family that's called Afroasiatic. And Afroasiatic, so ancient Egyptian is one of a number of families within Afroasiatic. Afroasiatic also includes, for example, the Semitic languages, modern Arabic and Hebrew. It includes languages like Berber, spoken by populations in the Sahara. It includes the Chadic languages spoken in the area of Central Africa that I work in. This is Afroasiatic is a very far-flung language family. It was spoken, for example, Akkadian, those people who were using Mesopotamian cuneiform to write their language of Akkadian were actually Afroasiatic speakers, as were ancient Egyptians. Ancient Egyptian was spoken by rural populations in Egypt until actually the 17th century AD. So we can think of continuity over that period of time, and it actually survives in a very, very modified form as Coptic, which is a language of worship in some Christian churches, Orthodox Coptic and Catholic Coptic churches in Egypt. So we have to think about, you know, this ancient Egyptian language spoken certainly before 3000 BC and continuing to be spoken, albeit less and less, by populations down until relatively recently, and obviously being modified and evolving through time. But again, that continuity is extraordinary. So, we can think about unity and diversity within cultural systems in the two areas. Similarly, the Egyptian dynastic system may give too much an impression of political continuity. We have these 30 dynasties, but obviously some of these dynasties weren't actually people who originated in the Nile Valley. Some of these 30 dynasties were not actually Egyptian. They ruled Egypt, but they had different ethnic and cultural origins. The people, for example, known as the Hyksos, who seem to have moved into the Nile Delta from the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, probably the area known as the Levant, and who briefly ruled Egypt. Libyans, generally meaning people from the west, not necessarily people from today's Libya. Nubians in the 25th dynasty, briefly ruling Egypt. On the other hand, even if this dynastic continuity may overstate the political continuity of ancient Egypt, it still is testament to the power of the political system and the influence that led even foreign invaders to adopt this system when they sought to rule the Nile Valley in both areas. We get cycles of centralization and dispersal of power. There were times when large areas of Mesopotamia were joined under one state, and periods when Egyptian political unity fell apart. But they tend to be of different lengths in both areas. Especially in the 3rd and 2nd millennia BC in Mesopotamia, the independence of city-states is the rule. That's not the case in Egypt. How do we understand this then? A well-known Canadian archaeologist, Bruce Trigger, also a significant theorist of archaeology and a very nice person, someone who unfortunately died just a few years ago, emphasized and analyzed the importance of a distinction between city-states and territorial states. The distinction is older in the archaeological literature, but he's its best-known recent theorist. Bruce Trigger saw pattern differences in the ways that these different kinds of political units, city-states and territorial states, controlled space. So let's think about some of those differences then. City-states control smaller territories with usually higher population densities, as was true in Mesopotamia vis-a-vis Egypt, for example. Other examples that we can use are the Greek city-states, the Maya city-states that we'll look at later in the course, city-states of the Benin and Yoruba people in West Africa, coastal West Africa, for example. Because the territories are small, these city-states are often more amenable to control over short distances by less elaborated bureaucracies. And we could see how this would work. The fact that it probably doesn't take as elaborate a bureaucracy to control lands that are 70 miles away vis-a-vis lands that are 700 miles away. City-states are often associated with more intensive agricultural systems in different parts of the world and a higher proportion of specialist producers. Economic relations between neighboring centers, because again, these centers are relatively close to one another, encourage the role of public markets and the role of widespread trading systems. And so the economic systems of city-states tended in ancient times to be more efficient and more responsive to change than was the case for territorial states. Territorial states, let's consider them briefly. The Egyptian state. Other examples include the Chinese states of the Shang dynasty, for example. The Inca state in the Andes of South America, both of which we'll talk about later. And probably, as a territorial state, Teotihuacan in the Valley of Mexico. And again, I'll talk about that later as well. Territorial states control large areas, usually through more elaborate bureaucratic hierarchies than are necessary for city-states. Their population densities are lower, and they're often associated with less intensive agricultural systems than our city-states. Urban centers are not so important in territorial states because they're not the focus of settlement and authority. Capitals are small, and it's also fairly frequent that capitals move around periodically. Not always, but periodically. In part because this is a way of responding to differences, developments in power and economy in different parts of larger territories. This actually was the case, as for example, in Egypt. We saw the first movement, not the last, but the first movement of the capital of Egypt from Abydos to Memphis at the beginning of the early dynastic period. These larger territorial states are more dependent on bureaucratic systems of control, and so local populations, rather paradoxically perhaps, are often less disturbed by the center. It's easier to get out from under the thumb of the center to some degree, I suppose, if your capital is 400 miles away as compared to 40 miles away. Territorial states in ancient times were subject to breakup, at which point political control would often revert to more local levels. In Egypt, to the local nomes, for example. Economic systems in territorial states are often less efficient than in city states, but because territorial states are larger in absolute terms, they can control greater quantities of resources and use them on, for example, larger building projects, like the pyramids. This distinction between city-states and territorial states is one that we're going to see in a number of different areas. It's sometimes assumed to be evolutionary, with city-states an earlier stage that develop into territorial states. However, in the Near East, this doesn't seem to be true. There were no Egyptian city-states that archaeologists have detected, and regional statehood was very often imposed upon Mesopotamia from outside. Next question we have to ask ourselves then, why might this distinction have come into being? In the particular case we're looking at, Egypt and Mesopotamia, archaeologists often trace these differences to the initial population densities relative to arable land in the Nile Valley and in the valley of the Tigris and Euphrates. There was generally less intensive exploitation of environments and lower population densities in the Nile Valley in the pre-dynastic period than was the case in Mesopotamia, for example, during the equivalent Uruk period. Higher population densities yield a web of closely spaced centers, giving rise to city-states in Mesopotamia, while lower densities result in a territorial state in Egypt. In part, we might be able to trace those differences then even further back to the different histories of the two areas through the Holocene, and especially the shorter period of farming and population increase before the pre-dynastic in Egypt. In addition, of course, the general physical configuration of the two areas leads to differences. Almost all of Egypt is easily accessible from the Nile, which facilitated movement of military forces and trade goods and so on. This did certainly aid cultural integration and incorporation into a centralized state at a relatively early period. That would have been much more challenging in Mesopotamia. But in Mesopotamia, it probably led to far more efficient and widespread trading systems by the Uruk period. Egypt's also generally more isolated than was Mesopotamia. There were Libyans in the western desert, and there certainly were invasions, but the Nile core was to some extent protected from external influences. In Mesopotamia, we find powerful populations and competitors to the east, north, and west. There was a greater degree of competition, and this is often where regional states later began. This model of city versus territorial states may well be oversimplified. And as we shall see, there are all kinds of complications to it in other areas. But in Egypt and Mesopotamia, at least, it seems to fit fairly well. What I'm going to do then in my next lecture is talk a little more generally about the question of territory in these ancient states and what territory and frontiers meant to states in ancient times. Because when I take a look at a map of the modern world and political units in the world today, and as you take a look at a map of nation-states in the world today, what I note is that that does not give us a good model of how political territories, how frontiers existed in ancient times. So we'll examine that question in my next talk. Thank you.